is the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Dan Strauss and Ian Geis are here with me. And Jim Miller is joining us on the phone now. Jim has written oral histories about ESPN called Those Guys Have All the Fun, and also a great one called Live from New York, which was about the history of Saturday Night Live, which he and Tom Shales did, and they came out with a revised edition a couple of years ago, which updated it with more than a decade's worth of material that they hadn't included and people who weren't in the first edition. And those were both great reads. I always enjoy reading oral histories because you're getting the first person stories of the people who were involved in them. And now Jim is back with a new book called Powerhouse, The Untold Story of Hollywood's CAA, Creative Artists Agency, which for which he did interviews with something like 500 different people, including people inside that agency and some of the people who they've represented, names that would blow you away. And Jim, I'm glad to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me back.
It's always a pleasure. The client list for CAA, when they started in 1975, was virtually nothing, but then expanded to include almost every major star I could name, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the reasons why I thought the place was bookworthy. Not only because it's a place that outside of Hollywood, not too many people really understand, and they don't understand the impact and that the agency has on their life and how often they intersect with the agency during the course of the day. But it's just a tremendous success story. I mean, like SNL and like ESPN, CA was started in the 70s from the most humble beginnings and then wound up being incredibly successful and is still a very, very big part of our world.
Now, before your book, the only thing I knew about CAA was a guy by the name of Michael Ovitz. And the only reason I know of him is because Treat Williams played him in The Late Shift, which was the HBO movie about the battle between Letterman and Leno for the succession of Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show.
Yeah, that was a pretty cool but brief part, and one of the fun things that I got to do in this book was to, I was actually able to interview Dave, and Letterman was great about Ovitz and about that part, that time in his life. I think people forget that when, Jay Leno got The Tonight Show, David Letterman was heartbroken, and his future was very much up in the air, and that's when he hired Mike Ovitz. And Dave and Ovitz and several other people in the book here talk about what those days were like, and it's pretty cool.
One of the amazing things that Ovitz did was he got the other networks that might have been interested in Dave to come and pitch themselves to him rather than Letterman going and pitching them. And in their pitches, Ovitz wrote in something like, I think it was $100 million penalty if they were not on at 11:30. And because NBC was putting, or 10:30 here in the Midwest, NBC was putting Leno in that slot, they could never match the offers that the other people had without paying $100 million.
It's, one of the things that's particularly cool in the book is just deal making. I mean, those kinds of stories and that moment, in fact, that they did for Dave actually created the opportunity for Dave to go to CBS, because without that, I don't think he could have gotten out of NBC.
And he stayed there for 20 plus years, making something like $35 million a year for all those years. Now, I got to ask you a question about Michael Ovitz. In reading the book, it occurs to me that I've just read about the most power hungry person I've ever heard of outside of politics. Would you agree?
That's interesting. Look, I think he's definitely on the Mount Rushmore. I mean, at least in recent times. But I think that I can convict or acquit, whichever one you want me to do, but I will say this. In terms of acquitting and defending him, Hollywood is a town that measures power. I mean, it measures money, but it also measures power. And the ability to do some of the things that Michael Ovitz did for his clients, I think that was one of the reasons why he and CA represented so many people. I mean, Ron Meyer and Bill Haber, there were two other guys who were basically principal partners at NCA. They were powerful as well. Power actually in Hollywood translates into things, because when you have power, you can get better deals for your clients. You can get them things that maybe another agency can't do. And when you have all those clients together, like CA, then all of a sudden you can say with a script like Rain Man, okay, we'll take Dustin Hoffman, we'll take Tom Cruise, we'll put our Barry Levinson in. By the way, they're all CA clients. We're going to take this together. We're going to do Ghostbusters. We're going to do, I mean, on and on and on and on and on. And, you know, even like ER, which was one of the most successful shows in television history, they found that in a storage room of scripts at CA, and they were able to get that on the air. So I think that power actually in Hollywood means something. It's not just for ego's sake.
Was CAA the first agency to package stars, directors, and projects and writers all together like that?
Well, not technically the first, no, but I think that they brought it, given their amazing lineup of talent, both in terms of in front of the camera and behind the camera. I think they brought it to unparalleled heights, that's for sure.
One thing that I know that they did for their clients was come up with the concept of getting the back end from gross points. Now, that's a technical showbiz term. Explain what that means.
So that means that when people go to the movie theater and the movie makes X amount of money, they're not going to deduct the expenses that they had against the movie. So there was a multitude. There were many clients at CAA in the late 80s and early 90s who were, you know, making north of, you know, $15 million a picture with gross points. And let me just say, it adds up.
Well, for instance, Jack Nicholson for Batman, the movie, the first one he did when he was the Joker opposite Michael Keaton, he got paid a little bit because he's Jack Nicholson, but then he got those back end points and ended up making over $100 million, didn't he?
I don't know if the number was $100 million, but you know what? It was a really good payday. I go through a case scenario with Robert Redford in Indecent Proposal, where the studio had a budget and they didn't want to pay Redford, you know, more than a certain amount, but he got that back end and he wound up pulling in, you know, over $30 million just from the back end of that one movie. So I think it can be highly significant and be a really nice pension fund for these actors.
And for the agency, does the agency get 10% of everything their clients do?
Yeah, so this is one of the things that I think is interesting, which is it's not just about what they're making now. I write in the book that if you were going into the CA mailroom now, they're still getting checks from Blake Edwards' estate for when he directed 10, the movie with Bo Derek.
Wow.
I mean, and that was in the 70s.
Wow.
So that, you know, all the money that comes in, I mean, they're still getting money off of Melrose Place. They're still getting money, you know, so I think all the money that comes in, it's not that you get the 10% once. It's the gift that keeps giving.
But there's an exception to that, and the exception is Seinfeld.
Oh, yeah, that was a fun thing to come upon, because I think in many ways it speaks to sometimes when people don't act like we thought they acted in Hollywood. Ron Meyer, who was one of the co-founders, he had a friend, Howard West and George Shapiro, who were Jerry Seinfeld's managers, and they couldn't fit into the budget for Seinfeld, you know, with CA's commission attached. And so Ron let them out of, Ron took away CA's commission on that show so those two guys could fit in. Now, I don't think Ron knew that the show is going to go on and be worth $4 billion, literally.
Yeah, by the way, when he says that, he's not kidding, because you include the streaming rights and the rerun rights, and, you know, forget about the old DVDs, that's over already. But in the digital era, Seinfeld has become worth $4 billion.
And that means that CA's commission, lost commission, was $400 million. And I have to say, though, when I confronted Ron Meyer about it, and I said, do you realize that when you did that, it cost the agency that much money? He said, you know what? I'd still do it again. It was the right thing to do for Howard and George, who were, you know, old friends of his from William Mars, and he really wanted them to be successful. Of course, I will say this, though. TV fans will remember that Jerry's pilot was called The Seinfeld Chronicles at the time.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody knew that it was going to become the financial juggernaut that that it did become. But, you know, Ron said to me, he said, I'd still do it again today.
Now, you write in the book about Jurassic Park, which was another one of these package deals that CAA put together. And though CAA was there at the beginning when they did the essential remake, Jurassic World, a couple of years ago, they don't get a piece of that. How come?
Well, CA does. My point in the book, though, was that when Michael Ovitz and Ron Meyer and Bill Haber left, you know, they founded the company in 1975. They left in 1995. They made a deal to exit the company. And I just think it's kind of ironic and worth noting that these guys who were terrific agents for their clients were not particularly great agents for themselves, because the deal that they made didn't have trailing revenues, which is to say that they didn't get, when Jurassic World opened, it's not like they got extra checks. You know, that went to CAA. And so I don't think they would have ever liked that kind of deal for a client of theirs, but it just so happened that the client in that case was themselves.
One of the other things I found interesting in here was, and I think it was Tom Hanks, who said CAA had so many big stars that it actually created an internal conflict of interest with stars going to them and saying, hey, how come you're giving that to that other client instead of to me?
Well, look, when you think about it, that's a pretty tough thing that they managed to balance, right? It's all about triage, because let's just say there's a great script inside, or there's a, you know, inside the agency. Well, when you're representing, you know, half the free world that's involved in, I mean, who do you give it to first? Who do you, if somebody passes, who do you give it to next? And I think that's one of the things that I kind of enjoyed writing about in the book, which was how they did that, how they went through that process of triage. And they were able, in, you know, for many, many years to keep a lot of people happy. That's not to say that sometimes, you know, some of their clients got a little ticked off when they saw other clients getting roles that they thought they should have had. But one of the agents, actually, Rick Nasita, goes into kind of detail about how they figured that out, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, the agency not only did movies and TV, but also expanded into music and sports. And I want to ask you a couple of questions about that. And the music question has to do with Fleetwood Mac. Is it true that if it were not for CAA, that Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks might never have joined John McVie, Christine McVie, and Mick Fleetwood and turned Fleetwood Mac from a kind of well-respected blues band into one of the most popular rock bands ever?
Well, it's more specific than just CA. It's Tom Ross, who was the first chairman of CA Music, and a wonderful, wonderful man, and a visionary. And I got to interview Mick Fleetwood, and they were with Tom Ross before, when he was at ICM, which is another agency before CA. And Tom not only gave them the support about those other players joining the band, but he also let them rehearse in the basement of ICM. They didn't have a place to rehearse.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, it was really interesting for me that when I said to Mick Fleetwood, why did you leave ICM and come over to CA? He said, well, that's where Tom was going. There was no way we weren't going to follow Tom. He was, you know, our godfather. I mean, it's funny, by the way, Tom Ross has a daughter named Rihanna. I mean, that's how close the bond is.
Wow.
And, you know, I just love those stories, because a lot of people, who cares what a talent agency is and whatever, but I think that people, one of the things that I'm hearing for this past week since the book came out is they don't realize that, or they didn't realize that, you know, CA, you know, it's Game of Thrones, it's Jimmy Fallon, it's Meryl Streep, it's Tom Cruise, it's, you know, you turn on your radio, it's Katy Perry or Lady Gaga, you watch football, it's J.J. Watt, basketball, Dwayne Wade. Even when you go into a Chipotle, I mean, CA advises and markets for Chipotle.
What?
Yeah, no. I mean, that's what I'm talking about. This is like, CA, the letters aren't as recognizable as ESPN or SNL, but it's actually much more part of our world. And so it's a place that's kind of secretive. They don't like bringing a lot of attention on themselves, but that's why I liked writing about it, because I think, you know, for people outside Hollywood, they really don't understand how all those dots are connected and what a place like that really is.
This is the company that just bought UFC for $4 billion.
No, that's their competitor, WME.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but they just bought their competitor, their main competitor, just bought the UFC for $4 billion.
But CAA is still involved in sports. I know you write in the book about how they were putting LeBron James' ESPN special, The Decision, together because he was a client of theirs. And I'm curious, because you wrote about ESPN in your earlier book, and then you wrote about this in this book, how those two worlds collided for you and whether the same people were saying the same things all these years later.
It was pretty cool. I mean, I think LeBron is terrific in this book. At the time, just think about this. At the time of The Decision, CA represented LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh. Mm-hmm. They represented all three.
Mm-hmm.
You think that's a little bit of a competitive advantage?
A little.
I mean, that was incredible. And I talked to Dwayne about what it was like to have the same agency representing all three of them. And I think that one of the things that was surprising to me, and I learned in my research and reporting, was that CA Sports now makes more money, brings in more revenue into CA than CA movies or television.
Wow.
So I think that says something about the world that we live in with sports.
Last person I've got to ask you about, Jim, is a guy by the name of Ari Emanuel, who was a big part of CAA and now runs the competitor, WME, and so famous as an agent that when Doug Ellen made his HBO series Entourage, he named one of the characters after him. That's the character that Jeremy Piven played, right?
Right. I interviewed Doug Ellen for the book. He's really great in the book, and he told me the story that it was originally, the character was going to be based on a CAA agent, and then he was in a meeting with Ari Emanuel, and he decided right in the room, he thought, wait a second, I gotta mouth it out to this guy. This guy is too much. I mean, the truth is, Ari wasn't like a big, powerful agent when he was at CAA. In fact, he left because he wanted to kind of create his own destiny and branch out. And he tells the funniest story about when he decided to leave. Basically, I'll just give away the punchline, which was that he threatened to throw a chair at Ovitz in his office. But typical Ari bravado. But I think that it's kind of interesting to see how he went about launching his career after CA, and that's part of the book as well.
All right, I got to bring this back full circle to Letterman, because you talked to him and you have him in the book. What did he tell you about his last days at CBS?
He was ready to go. He felt like the old man on the block. Jay had already left, and he thought that it was time to go. And he wanted to go. One of the things that he said was he wanted to go on his timetable, on his terms, rather than stay there and have to have the network come to him and say, "Listen, we're replacing you." And I think that gives Dave a lot of credit. And I think, it's something that we, should always remember about Dave, because he wasn't one of those people that was going to hang around until it was too late. And he did on his own terms.
I would argue he did hang around until it was too late by several years. But I think he just wanted to stick around until Leno lost his seat officially for the second time, and then decided to go. The book is called Powerhouse, The Untold Story of Hollywood's Creative Artists Agency. And here's the guy who compiled that oral history, James Andrew Miller. Jim, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.